Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. This is a show that I've been looking forward to for quite a long time because we're not going to talk about politics on Political Rewind for just today, although I can't say for certain it won't come into the conversation in some way or another. Instead, we're continuing our series of conversations that we'll be doing throughout the year with important thought leaders in Georgia and beyond. And today, we are joined by, I have to be honest, one of my favorite people in Georgia, the Reverend Dr. Joanna Adams, a longtime Presbyterian minister at churches in Atlanta. She served as the pastor of Morningside Presbyterian Church in the city, Trinity Presbyterian Church. She served in Chicago at the Fourth Presbyterian Church. And she also was an interim pastor at Atlanta's First Presbyterian Church. Lots of Presbyterian churches in Joanna Adams' career. But she's also well-known and so well-respected for being a community leader and someone who has for years worked on building bridges among diverse communities, faith communities, and beyond. I want to talk to her. And by the way, Joanna Adams and I have known each other for a very long time. And so we're going to talk as friends in the sense that we're going to dispense with Reverend Dr. Joanna Adams. I'm going to call you Joanna. And I know you prefer that, actually, don't you?
I definitely do.
Thank you so much for being here today. I'm really glad that we could have this conversation, Joanna. I want to start by asking you this. I know that you come from a line of faith leaders, ministers, and I want you to tell us a little about that. And as you do, I kind of want to hear you talk about when God first came into your life. If you recall how young you were when God first came into your life.
Well, I can't recall it specifically because, you know, the whole idea of my being came from God. And I've always had the sense that I was put on the earth to do something that was meaningful in it. But I will say that one of my favorite games when I was a child, and I'm talking about, you know, 5 and 6, I remember lining up my stuffed animals and my dolls on my bed and preaching to them. I had a little desk that looked a little bit like a pulpit. And I will say, Bill, that was continues to be the most attentive congregation I've ever preached to. No muscle was moved. No eye was batted. I think I was born into a home where, you know, we went to Sunday school and went to church, and I loved church, and I loved Sunday school, and I loved Bible stories, and it was just a match made in heaven, shall we say. Though people who knew me growing up would not have said, "Now there's a preacher to be," because I was not pious at all.
First, go back a little bit. Talk about your family's history in the church.
Well, all my grandfathers on my mother's side, going back at least 4 or 5 generations, were all ministers in South Georgia, and my grandfather was someone I never knew personally because he died when mother was 13. But I grew up hearing stories about him and his ministry and the kind of person he was. You called him Papa, and we had some hard times in our home with some mental illness, and you know, I loved the world that Mother had grown up with, and he was just one of my heroes. And it never occurred to me that I could grow up and be a minister. The first woman I ever heard pray in public was myself. Honestly, I'd never heard a woman even say a prayer in public when I was growing up in Mississippi in the 50s.
So you come out of that tradition of having had grandparents who were in the church. They were Methodists, I think. You became a Presbyterian.
That's right.
Of course. But I do want to, I want to read something that you wrote, because it forms a lot of what I'd like to talk with you about. And I don't know if this was a sermon or something you wrote for publication somewhere. You'll know that, I assume. You said, there are so many people today who do not have clarity about their religious identity. They were either not raised in the church or raised in the church, but now feel as if they no longer fit in the tradition in which they were brought up. Many have moved away from belief and want to believe again. Many are on a genuine quest for a Christian message that engages the mind as well as the heart, for a system of religious meaning that has depth, breadth, and staying power, and will enable them to ground their lives and engage their society from a perspective of faith and hope. And I think that that is really a very powerful statement about where a lot of people find themselves in the search for meaning beyond themselves. And I'm one of those, Joanna. I was raised both Catholic and Jewish. My father was Catholic. My mother was Jewish. And I actually spent my first 12, 13 years going to Catholic church, making a first communion, all of that, but ended up following my mother's Judaism, which is what the way I define myself today. But in the middle of all that, I still am not certain where I fit in terms of the way I reach out to a God. So with that in mind, I do want to go back to when you were younger, when you were praying as a child, when you were learning about God. How did prayer start for you?
Just very simply, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. And when I'm going through a rough patch at the ripe old age of, well, I won't even name my age, but it's ripe, let's put it that way. I sometimes find myself praying that as I close my eyes and go to sleep. And it's a great prayer of trust. If I should die before I wake, I pray thee, Lord, my soul to take. My life and my death are in God's hands. And I don't know, for me, Bill, it was just very intuitive. In college, I went through a phase, and right after college, where I thought I knew everything, and I really wanted to move away from what I felt was kind of a closed-minded Christian piety that soaked the society that I grew up in Mississippi. I didn't want that. I knew that wasn't going to sustain me, and I didn't want to be a part of a faith tradition. And in the white church in the South, you know, the God is in heaven and all's right with the world. So you go to church and the world is not there. And I really had a conversion experience when I had, I think our son Sam is now 52, when I was, had a, Sam was, Elizabeth was three and Sam was a baby, and we had visited a little church in our neighborhood, and a member of the church staff called me and said, Joe, people call me Joe then, I understand you're a teacher. We visited the church once. And I said, yes, I taught at Grady High School, as a matter of fact. And she said, well, we need you to help out at the Scottsdale Daycare Center for poverty-stricken kids in the Scottsdale mill community. And I laughed and said, you know, I'm teaching Silas Marner. I don't know anything about three-year-olds. And this wonderful person's name was Donna. She said, well, Joe, we need you on Thursday. And I found a babysitter and went and sat with those kiddos, and lunch was served. And the kids at my table, the little boy next to me, I said, tell me what's on your plate. You know, tell me what we're eating today. And he did not know the name of green peas. And we lived in Decatur, then we lived 2 miles apart. And so it was the church, that it was that experience, that it's not to me to be a Christian is to follow the way of Christ. You know, I don't worry about, and I don't want anybody to worry about whether he or she has his or her soul saved. I believe God took care of that. As a Christian, I believe that and trust that with all my heart in Christ and his suffering and death and resurrection. That's where I look to for salvation. But I love God. I chose to accept the gift of faith. And I think faith is a spiritual gift, but you had to be open to it.
And that was the revelation that came out of that encounter, is what you're telling us.
That's exactly what I'm telling you. That God doesn't dwell in the sanctuary. God agrees to meet us there for worship. But by the time that benediction is said, you know, the work of God, the Holy Spirit is out there, and you'll find God's work in places where people suffer and are vulnerable, and where people are hungry, where justice is not prevailing. And that's the script for my life.
I want to make sure we point something out. A lot of the conversation that we're going to have today in talking about God, talking about religion, is going to be about Christianity, because that's the faith you're grounded in. But one of the most admired aspects of your life is how closely you've worked with people of other faith leaders, other congregations of people who are Jewish, are Islamic. And I think it's important to point that out. And I here's something else that at one point I read that you had said. You, in that regard, you said the Christian tradition, just as the Jewish tradition, has one central claim, and it's "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." In Hebrew, Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu. You know that prayer well. So we're going to talk about Christianity, but there's nothing in our conversation that we can't extrapolate as being part of other people's faith practice as well, right?
For sure. We're all people of place. And, my place in the world has put me on the Christian path. But goodness sake, do I believe with all my heart that all people, people of different faiths and people of no faith, are precious, beloved children of God. And none of us is better than any of the other of us. And I happen to follow, the path I was born into. But goodness sake, and I don't even know where that came from. I remember when I was pastor at Trinity, and terrible things happened in the world. And, you know, Alvin Sugarman was my friend. So I called Alvin, and Alvin called me, and Joe Roberts and Pleman El-Amin, and, you know, and we were natural allies because we were, I don't know, we were friends. We shared the same values. And I often said when I was in the parish that, you know, I had more in common with, people like Clement L. Amin and Alvin Sugarman than I did with 99% of Christian clergy who were heading in such a conservative way. And, you know, I just really parted company with the right wing direction of the church, Plimon, and the conservative direction.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Plimon El Amin, one of the leaders in the Muslim community of Georgia for a very long time, and Alvin Sugarman, the longtime rabbi at the temple, one of the most acclaimed, one of the most well-known synagogues in Metro Atlanta. And you all work together on a lot of issues, and I assume that means, among other things, working on how, in your own ways, you came together to talk about civil rights and social justice, yes?
Absolutely, absolutely, for sure. And, there was a consortium of religious leaders who cared deeply about civil rights, Joe Roberts, Timothy McDonald, I could just go on and on, Gerald Durley, some of us are still alive, but there was just a shared concern for the well-being of all people, not just some people, and the commitment to do justice and love mercy and not be puffed up about it, as the prophet Micah suggested. You know, we didn't ever pat ourselves on the back. I just a shout out to the Community Foundation, when Alicia Phillip was head of it, she got a grant to start something called Higher Ground. At my retirement, Plimon and Dr. Roberts and Alvin Sugarman spoke, and the week after, Alicia called and said, "You all need to go on the road." Four religious leaders who are friends, and for years, like 4 or 5 years, we went all over Metro Atlanta. I remember the four of us, we were a panel, and we would talk about issues from our different perspectives, and we didn't always agree on everything. I remember Alvin and I got into a big argument about the sovereignty of God, whether God was in charge of everything or not. Alvin said, you know, listen, God, the creator, put us on this earth and said, okay, it's all in your hands now. You better do right. And, you know, here I am, this Presbyterian, all about the problem. Anyway, it was friendship and relationship and shared values that came naturally. We didn't, none of us started thinking, oh, we need to be an interfaith and start an organization. It's about who we were.
One of the reasons I think it's fair to say that social justice, racial equality, seeing the wrongs that people have done in the name of race, is important to you is because of where you grew up. You were in what, Meridian, Mississippi?
That's right, Mississippi.
Not far from Philadelphia, Mississippi.
From Philadelphia.
Tell us about that.
Well, in our church, which was, you know, the biggest Methodist church in town, not a word was ever said about Emmett Till's death. Nothing was ever said about what happened in Philadelphia. It was God is in heaven, and all that matters is your relationship, your personal relationship, and your own salvation and your prayer life and that sort of thing. And I certainly wasn't in any way a rabble rouser at the time, but I don't know. I just always had a feeling that things weren't right. But no, it was, you know, the atmosphere, the weather, the moral weather was, it was like being in a different world.
Yeah. So I'm going to keep coming back, if you don't mind, to your earliest roots, because I'm really fascinated by how religion, prayer, a love of God develops in people. But in addition to loving God as a younger person, there was somebody else you were quite enamored with, Annie Oakley. Oh. How did you what was it about the sharpshooter Annie Oakley that you found so fascinating?
To this day, in my study, I have a huge poster of Annie Oakley, and it's a sketch of her, and she's wearing a cowgirl outfit, and she's holding a rifle. And the title of the poster is Annie Oakley, Peerless Lady Wing Shot. And she just seemed like a strong person who knew what to do and wasn't afraid to do it. And she's been a role model for me. I named my first dog Miss Annie after Annie Oakley.
And you said
a cowgirl skirt outfit. You know, it was about empowerment of women, and I didn't even know that at the time. I didn't know that's what it was about. But good Lord, women weren't empowered, and in the ways that we can be ourselves now. And yet there was always something in me that knew that I just couldn't. And I've been married 57 years and I have two wonderful children. But that's not all I was created to do or be.
I think you've said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there are times when Annie Oakley inspired you when you were thinking about the sermons you wanted to write. You knew you had to take aim, hit the target, do it efficiently.
Exactly. I wanted to be peerless in delivering the word so that it hit home. And, there are all kinds of things that God preaches, but what has always guided me, I wanted to touch people's real hearts and minds so that something good could happen inside them. I wanted to give that gift of hope, of the reality of God's eternal love. I just had to do it. It was my gift, not my gift, God's gift through me. Peerless Lady Wingshot.
Apparently it worked, because I think that you went through these obstacles in which churches, when they first talked with you, there were members of the congregation that said, we don't want a woman running, as the pastor of our church. But in every church, I believe, that you have served as pastor, you have doubled the size of the congregation. So you must have been doing something right.
That is correct. And then certainly in the beginning, when I first started out at Central Presbyterian Church in the late 70s, in the meeting where they talked about whether they were going to call me or not, someone stood up and said, well, is she of the childbearing age? Horrors, fun horrors that the ministers, anyway, that's where we started.
Okay, so I want to, let's go back to talking about God. You believe that God will give us what you would call unconditional love, no matter the circumstance.
Correct.
Talk about that. Talk about that.
Well, I guess the word that comes to mind, use the word unconditional love, which I think is a factor of the grace of God. And that regardless of whether we're creeps or not, and all of us are a mix of creepiness and non-creepiness. We cannot prove our own worth or earn God's favor. And there's nothing we can do to stop the flow of God's love and grace. Even on the cross, the criminal next to Jesus. Jesus said, "I'll see you in paradise, sir." And he was the guilty one.
But okay, we got to get to a break. But when I hear that, it sounds to me like, before we go to break, you're suggesting that no matter my behavior, I can end up in paradise. And it seems to me that frees me up to be as awful a person as I want to be. I will still have God's grace and unconditional love. That seems like a paradox.
Well, it certainly is a mental conundrum and a theological conundrum. Do I have time to answer it now, or you need to go to the break now?
Let's take a break. I do want to hear your answer when we come back on Political Rewind. All right. On Political Rewind today, we're talking to the Reverend Dr. Joanna Adams, who is one of the most highly respected and beloved pastors, now retired from the Presbyterian Church in Georgia. And she's part of our series of conversations with thought leaders that will go on throughout 2023. Before we got to the break, Joanna, I asked you, if I get unconditional love from God, what's the incentive to behave well if I'm going to end up someday in paradise?
The unconditional love of God, the in Protestant tradition, and that I come from, is irresistible grace and unconditional love. So the power in the universe comes from divine grace and divine love. And if I can be open to receiving God's love and unconditional grace, even if I've really messed up and continue to mess up, I want to respond by living a grateful and faithful life. That's where the power comes from. I remember a wonderful theologian being asked whether she, the theologian, thought that a lot of people were going to hell. And she answered, "Listen, sir, I'm only a professor at Harvard Divinity School. I'm going to leave people's eternal destiny up to God. I'm not keeping count."
I love that. I love that. You said a little while ago that you had the calling to help fill people's lives with an understanding of grace, of the Holy Spirit. You wanted to inspire them to a love of God. And it strikes me that one of the most powerful things about being a faith leader, a pastor of a church, a rabbi, an imam, is you are present for people's most joyous moments and also their greatest sorrows. You're there for the baptism of a new baby. You're there for the life cycle changes, the marriage. And then you're there for the funeral. And I've always thought that must bring your life into such a sharp focus in so many ways.
Well, it certainly does. I remember when I was doing chaplaincy work in seminary as part of my training, I was on the neurosurgery floor at Georgia Baptist Hospital as my assignment. And there was a young woman on our floor who had terminal brain cancer, was close to death. And I remember standing outside the door of her room with my hand prepared to knock. And I just about had a panic attack. I thought, what in the world am I doing here in the face of this wonderful young woman's imminent death? What can I say? What use am I? And I thought, well, I can't answer that question. But my choice is either to take the plunge or walk away. And I put my hand on the door and went in and realized that God had given me from another realm the strength and the kind of soothing presence that really does come from another realm. And I just trust that if God wants me to keep doing this work, and I've actually, you know, you talked about weddings and baptisms, I adore them, but I will say spiritually for me, the most meaningful experiences have to do with loss and death. And that's such a privilege. And I learned so much from people in terms of their own courage, their own resources, to be able to say goodbye, to handle pain, to handle loss with such grace and dignity. I wouldn't do anything else in this life because of the privilege.
What is that? I apologize again for interrupting. What have those experiences taught you about reflecting upon the fact that you'll eventually die?
I will say that I don't, I don't reflect on that a lot. I had a great privilege. I mean, this is the truth, I'm going to say. But I had the great privilege some years ago of serving on a committee, which doesn't sound like a blessing, which wrote a creed for the Presbyterian Church. And it's one of our creeds, like the Apostles' Creed, you know, it's now in our Book of Confessions. And it begins with a line from a confession written in the 1600s, at the beginning of the Reformation. In life and in death, we belong to God. I bet my life, Bill, on the reality of that. And I can't tell you that what I believe I can prove. I absolutely cannot prove anything except that I have experienced as I have lived the grace and love and redemptive power of grace and love. And I just can't imagine. I really think about this. I can't imagine that the Creator who made us and gave us life on this earth and filled it with so much beauty and so many blessings along with the thorns and the heartaches, that God would say, okay, you're dead, you're gone. I just don't think God ever intended to be finished with us.
Does that mean there's a heaven?
Oh, I definitely believe there's a world beyond this. I'm not a reality beyond this. And I'm not a medievalist that there's a heaven above and hell below. But I really do that God's infinite love includes us, even though we are mortal and finite. I really do believe this world is the beginning and not the end. I think Emily Dickinson wrote that. This world is the beginning and not the end.
And is that the sort of thing you talked about, the experience of going in to see this young woman and being fearful that you didn't know how you would talk to her as she was dying? Is that the sort of thing you talk about to someone who is close to death?
What I just talked to you about? Yes. But I want to get, I want to be with whoever it is I've been called to walk beside and to see what that particular person needs at that particular moment. And, you know, so the patient or the one with the problem or this issue that is my teacher, really, they tell me what I need. And I certainly don't preach, but I'm the ministry of presence is like 99% of ministry. Showing up, shutting up, and listening.
Well, I want to talk about showing up. And the notion of shutting up in another context with you. I read something you either wrote or gave in a sermon in which you talk about, I think the question was, should there be a clock in a sanctuary, a clock that the pastor, that the preacher would see.
That's right.
from wherever they were preaching. And in that piece, you talk about the fact that everybody's watching the clock in one way or another when they're sitting in church, and you believe very strongly that people came into church, I think, believing, let's do an hour and get out of here, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And behind that is a joke that, you know, about the preacher who had timed, he put little candies in his mouth and he had timed the disappearance of them down to an arc so that he knew just when to quit preaching as these things melted in his mouth. And one day it was, he didn't let the congregation out till 12:25. And one of his elders complained about it at the door of the sanctuary, and he said, I have to apologize. The minister did. I had one Altoid in my mouth and one button, and the Altoid disappeared, but the button never dissolved. So,
all right.
That
so,
made me
so,
go on I, and on.
All right. So you, I have to say, having prepared for this show by reading a number of your sermons, you are just a marvelous writer, an efficient writer. Your writing is so smart, and you have such a unique take as you write your sermons. But part of that is probably because you are so aware of the time frame in which you need. You're Annie Oakley. I need to hit the target and gallop on.
Right. And I, you know, I will say, you know, I edit myself and still preach too long. But I will hear a good sermon and I'll, you know, Al and I will leave the church sanctuary. And so that was such a good sermon. If I could have just cut out so much of it, because we talk and then we talk more and then we talk, say too much, that the, should there be a clock in the sanctuary, really has to do with my responsibility of knowing what time it is in the life of a congregation, in the life of the city. What time is it? And, you know, and a wonderful theologian that from Canada that I love told the story of how it was that throughout the history of Christianity, in any era in history, you could say anything. There were, you know, there are millions of words and billions of doctrines and all of that. And he said, the Christian church in Germany in the 1930s had one thing to say. And the it was time to say it. And there was never a time where it was more important than to say this: Jesus was a Jew.
Oh.
That's what I mean about knowing what time it is.
Well, and you know what? I want to get our final break of the show out of the way, but what you just said leads me into what I think we could talk about when we come back, and that is, what time is it right now, Joanna Adams, given the turmoil in our politics, given the anger and rage that so many people experience right now, what time is it for the church, for the synagogue, for the mosque? We'll do that when we come back on Political Rewind. Joanna Adams, most of the polling, the surveys, the anecdotal evidence is that church attendance, synagogue attendance, younger people are not getting involved with organized religion in quite the way that they used to. And in much the same way that you talk about in Germany, in the 30s, the churches should have preached Jesus was a Jew. It strikes me that in many ways, this is a time that our faith is more important than ever. Tell us what you think, you as a minister, should be paying attention to as you look at what time it is in our country.
I would say that the irrelevance of so much of what faith communities claim to be about, that's real. And sometimes Al and I will visit a church, and honestly, I have one of these radars in me where I can tell there's a spirit in this place is good, or I feel like I'm in a mausoleum, and you know, people are just going through the motions, and they're so inner-directed. You know, they're arguing about silly things that don't make a bit of difference in the world. So I think it's the church's fault in a lot of ways. I think institutional religion, and particularly mainline Protestantism, of which I'm, you know, a total member, I think we sort of lost our way and started trying to please people and offering religion light, L-I-T-E. And there's so much of mainline religion is not gripping at all. And I think the timidity of the clergy has a lot to do with that. You know, you use the word, you talked about polarization. To me, you know, I've served different kinds of churches. The church that I think is the most important today would be, if you want to mix politics in here, would be a purple church, a purple congregation, where people who are Republican, where people who are Democrat, we can come together for one reason. God is one, and we're here to worship God and to find out what God wants us to do in this world. And where can we find places where we agree and can join hands? I'm just thinking of two or three things that have grown out of faith communities that you know, involve all kinds of people. And that's what we have to do. We have to do that. The issues that I think are the most pressing in our modern time, this polarization that you talk about and our tendency to demonize others is terrible and not from God. And I'll be sitting at a dinner table with, you know, loving progressive liberals, and there'll be people be talking ugly about people. What's good about that? Once you demonize somebody, you've taken away their humanity. You don't see it. And you're never going to have a good country in that way. In the climate change, I don't know why the faith community in leading the parade, and rather than being the caboose on the train, pardon my mixing my metaphors, but for God's sake, God created this world and entrusted it to our care. And we have blown that. And if we don't watch it, there won't be generations and generations to come for flora or fauna or little boys and little girls. And the last thing, I cannot believe that we are a society in which we're shooting the guts out of one another by the dozens every day. After the shooting in Texas of school children, I watched something that showed when a bullet entered a little boy, a little 8-year-old boy's chest, what an AR rifle bullet did to his body. Think, where are we? What have we done? If there is a hell, people who don't give a hoot about gun violence and gun safety are candidates. That's, and I'm Miss Annie Oakley. I myself have a shotgun to shoot skeet because I like shooting skeet. But we are in a terrible mess. And that I don't know why that isn't on the front burner. I will give a shout out to the temple and to St. Luke's Episcopal Church, the Ebenezer Baptist Church. Interfaith coalition is gathering now around gun violence. And I have to say, I called one of our Presbytery executives a year or so ago and said, what are the Presbyterian churches doing about gun violence? And that executive said, nothing as far as I know.
Do you feel like, having been retired for a while, you're missing an opportunity to be back engaged in it, with a congregation in that work?
I personally do. I'm in this interfaith thing. I'm also quite aware of what a touchy subject it is. But I'm, you know, when you're retired, you know, I don't give much of a hoot about touchiness anymore, you know.
We're almost out of time. I'm going to ask you another. I started asking you this, and it's kind of the last thing I'll get to ask, and I don't have a lot of time to hear what I want to hear. Joanna, I find praying really difficult. Partly because I don't know about God, but also I close my eyes, I try to start a conversation, and it just never goes anywhere. Give me a couple quick tips. What do I need to be doing?
Well, you need to stop relying on yourself, for one thing. Get the Jewish prayer book, for God's sake. You know, there are a lot of psalms. You could read a psalm a day and sit there and think and then say amen. Prayer is not a work. It's, it's an acknowledgement that there's something beyond ourselves that's good.
Joanne Adams, I could not ask for a better way for us to conclude our conversation. You are one of the great treasures of our community, and I'm so pleased that we could spend the last hour discussing all of the things that you talked about. Thank you so much for being with us today, Joanna. That's all the time we have left for today's Political Rewind. We'll be back again tomorrow with another brand new show. We're going to talk about the tumultuous 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago with an author who says that the events that took place on the streets and in the convention hall changed forever how media reports on live breaking news. Until then, I'm Bill Nygut. Take care, stay healthy, and be good to one another. See you tomorrow.